You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
The Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, as we aspire to get our guest on the phone. Yes, okay. So, it is our two dragon once our guest joins us, Valentine's Day Metaphysics of Whistleblowing. We will be welcoming the return of John Kiriakou, CIA whistleblower who has journeyed through the underworld to emerge as liberating citizen trickster with language craft, and we want to honor what are the underworld skills, what underworld skills do we need that we may dispel the distracting bamboozlements and align with the rising tide of sane reverent ingenuity. So we will, there, it's perfect actually, well, we hope so, that we are, well, we are waiting, but there is one wonderful things I want to read while we're waiting. From Facebook, a great ally, Joseph Barney, posts Alan Moore's post, which says, "There is some confusion as to what magic actually is. I think this can be cleared up if you just look at the very earliest descriptions of magic. Magic is the earliest form, is often referred to as the art. I believe this is completely literal. I believe that magic is art, and that art, whether it be writing, music, sculpture, or any other form, is literally magic. Art is, like magic, the science of manipulating symbols, words, or images to achieve changes in consciousness. The very language about magic seems to be talking as much about writing or art as it is about supernatural events. A grimoire, for example, the Book of Spells, is simply a fancy way of saying grammar. Indeed, to cast a spell is simply to spell, to manipulate words, to change people's consciousness. And I believe that this is why an artist or a writer is the closest thing in the contemporary world that you are likely to see to a shaman. I believe that all cultures must have arisen from cult. Originally, all of the facets of our culture, whether they be in the arts or sciences, were the province of the shaman. The fact that in present times this magical power has degenerated to the level of cheap entertainment and manipulation is, I think, a tragedy. At the moment, the people who are using shamanism and magic to shape our culture are advertisers. We're going to go into lots of things there. Rather than try to wake people up, their shamanism, or we're going to say faux shamanism, is used as an opiate to tranquilize people, to make people more manipulable. Their magic box of television and by, you know, and by their magic words, their jingles, can cause everyone in the country to be thinking the same words and have the same banal thoughts all at exactly the same moment." A little sidebar now, you know, words that are in common use, people often say that triggers me, and we go, well, that makes one a gun, right? And we are on Valentine's Day, which is the horrific anniversary of the Parkland murder of 17 people, many of whom were students. And we go, right, so we just want to question our language always. So in all of magic, there's an incredibly large linguistic component. The bardic tradition of magic would place a bard as being much higher and more fearsome than a magician. A magician might curse you. That might make your hands lay funny, or you might have a child born with a difficult circumstance. If a bard were to place not a curse upon you, but a satire, that could destroy you. Sidebar, remember that the Celts thought that the most effective way of bringing down an unruly tyrant was satire. We're going to honor what's available to us. If it was a clever satire, it might not just destroy you in the eyes of your associates, it would destroy you in the eyes of your family, it would destroy you in your own eyes. And if it was a finely worded and clever satire, that might survive and be remembered for decades, even centuries. Then, years after you were dead, people still might be reading it and laughing at you and your wretchedness and your absurdity. Writers and people who have command of words were respected and feared as people who manipulated magic. In latter times, I think that artists and writers have allowed themselves to be sold down the river. They have accepted the prevailing belief that art and writing are merely forms of entertainment. They're not seen as transformative forces that can change a human being, that can change a society. They are seen as simple entertainment, things with which we can fill 20 minutes, half an hour, while we're waiting to die. It's not the job of the artist to give the audience what the audience wants. If the audience knew what they needed, then they wouldn't be an audience. Well, you know, we can argue with Alan Moore about some points, but anyway, they would be the artist. It's the job of artists to give the audience what they need. We go, may it be so. So we are aspiring again to get our guest's correct phone number. There we go. Let's pray, everybody. It's a quirky time. But just for the fun of it, here's what I wrote to John Kiriakou, who has been a guest twice before, but apparently his phone number has changed. Okay, we don't know what. But he is playful, you know, a serious person who's also playful. So here's what I had written to John, because we want to invite our mythic selves to cavort, even when someone might be disguised as a grown-up. So what I said to him and to everyone, remembering that radio is an opportunity for collective magic, and that the protoplasm of reality is especially receptive to imaginative imprint. So we want to critique the horrific and animate the desirable, lest we leave opportunity by default to the dementors of doom. We remember we all have our magic mirror, you know, which is we hold up a mirror to society, you know, and go, oh, it's our critique, and go, oh, no, it sucks in detail. And then with a wave of our hand, our paw, we turn the mirror into a window. But look how beautiful it could be. And then with another wave of the hand or paw, we turn it into a door. Let's go. And, you know, again, telepathically communing with our guest. There we go. There we go. I said, if we think of you as having elements of Carl Jung and Merlin, and why not? He's up for this. What would you most like to be revealed, rendered harmless, and in the fullness of time, an occasion for collective liberating mirth? And what are the distracting sleight of hand bamboozling narratives? This is what we want to kind of put on our work table, too. There's so much, you know, it's like, all right, the Russian investigation, many, many points of view. Some say it's nonsense, some say whatever, but it is not the only thing. It is not the only thing. Remember beautiful Ellen Page in A Remarkable Moment. Yes, that's the number that we have. I'm talking to the spirits back there. Yes. Okay. Back to experiment of intimacy with our dedicated listeners. But it's not the only thing. And as Ellen Page said, who's telling the story and who gets to be in the story? We go, yeah. And what intelligence, capital I intelligence, in the collective shall we bless and encourage? An opportunity for a clarion call to contribute to a rising tide of sanity. And the value of journeying through the underworld to emerge as liberating citizen trickster with language craft. So I asked to him and to all of us, what are the underworld skills that we need? You know, and what I said to him and then to all of us, you know, he worked for intelligence, he worked for the CIA, you know, a faux intelligence, and now you work for authentic intelligence. May it be so. So there we have these things. And I think what we might do for a moment is possibly take a little break music. We might do our break early while we aspire to find our guest. That could be really great. All right, just bear with me, team. That's right, we're backstage, we're okay, all right, there we go, all right, there we go, thank you. This is very real, we're all intimately here together. Aha, great, thank you. Okay, that will do. So let me weave a little context, and our guest should be here pretty soon. There we go. Thank you, team. But part of the beauty, the Valentine's Day gift to all of us, and let me remind us also, what is Valentine's Day? What is this thing? Well, you know, thanks to Patricia Ewing, great scholar of early Christianity, it really is underneath all of the rubble and the Hallmark card and everything. It was for almost Pope Valentinius. And Valentinius was a Gnostic mystic. He was in favor of complete equality between men and women, and also in the church at that time. One week you might be a priest, and then the next week you would be a layperson, and the layperson would be a priest. So really what we're honoring deeply underneath everything is true equality. That is our aspirational dynamic. And also just, you know, now to kind of weave the larger theme, the Valentine's Day present was Mars, our woofiness, today moved into Taurus, the realm of feminine sensuality and kinship and animism and cooperating with everything. And it leads the way for Uranus, nature's evolutionary trickster genius. Whoops, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right. And you're there. You're there, John Kiriakou?
Hi, I sure am.
That's a wonderful thing. Yes, your previous number was out of order. All right, now, but I got the mythic part out of the way, although it's informing everything. But we go, okay, welcome, two dragons, a fellow dragon. It is our Valentine's Day metaphysics, really, of whistleblowing. We welcome the return of John Kiriakou, CIA whistleblower, who has journeyed through the underworld to emerge as liberating citizen trickster with language craft. And so we want to honor, you know, what are the underworld skills? What underworld skills do we need to dispel the distracting bamboozlements and align with the rising tide of sane reverent ingenuity? His website is John Kiriakou, KIRIAKOU.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at John Kiriakou. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Well, it's always a delight, and I love your playful self, and I love your response when I said, well, let's think of you as having elements of Carl Jung and Merlin, and why not? You know, so what would you like most to be revealed, rendered harmless, and in the fullness of time, an occasion for collective liberating mirth? So there's a lot of narration. I love from your Twitter feed, you know, finding the article by the fantastic woman, Kashmir Hill, on her experiment of blocking Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Apple for 6 weeks. All right, that's something that was on your Twitter feed, right?
Yes, fantastic piece, wasn't it?
It is a fantastic piece, and I'm spiraling it forth. But I got that from you, and yeah, just so because you know you and Edward Snowden are, you know, kinned deep divers into the underworld, you know, and it's just yeah the technology of supervision. So yeah, anywhere you want to honor that and direct people to that piece is great.
I'll tell you, I happened to be in London a couple of weeks ago for a panel discussion on whistleblowing, and Ed was the other member of the panel. I hadn't spoken to him it's been probably 3 years. And of course, he Skyped in from Moscow. But he said something that I've never heard him say before, and it was so humbling. I've just been thinking about it for the last 2 weeks. He said that he followed every aspect of my case, and when I was convicted for my whistleblowing, that's when he decided to go public. And he said that had there been no John Kiriakou, there would have been no Ed Snowden. And that was just such an honor to hear those words. I still can't get over it.
That's so wonderful. Yeah.
Oh, just great. He was just great. Very generous.
He is. Yeah. And so you spoke to him, you know, quite recently. And then also just the interview he did, I guess, at the end of the previous year was so calm and likable. And Katie Couric was like, shouldn't we be frightened? Shouldn't we be frightened? He's like, no, we shouldn't be frightened. We should be ready. He was very likable and strong and not bitter, you know, in his affect.
Not at all bitter. And you get a sense, and I don't use this word lightly, but you get a sense of his genius when you're able to sit and listen to him at length. I have to keep reminding myself that he's as young a man as he is, but his command of the issues, his ability to convey very complicated topics very simply, is truly amazing. I was captivated by his by his points.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because just for the fun of it, because you seemed playful when several episodes back when I hosted you, I said, you know, you, like Carl Jung, are the sun, have the sun in Leo square, Neptune in Scorpio, a lifelong wondering about illusion, delusion, and the power of symbols. And you said, yes, I know that. I go, all right, we're on. So you and Edward Snowden are quite astro-mythologically kinned, you know, again, that diving deep into the underworld, you know, and returning, and may he return, but there is also a, you know, a pattern of, you know, may you and he, and I love that story that you inspired him, that's so wonderful, you know, may there be enhanced, you know, collective receptivity to what you and what he have to say, because it's ever more important, right? Yeah,
I hope so. Well, I think it is. And, you know, at the very beginning of the Trump administration, a reporter called me and asked me if I thought things would be better or worse for whistleblowers. And it wasn't just me. They asked Tom Drake and Jesselyn Radack and Bill Binney and a couple of other people who have been national security whistleblowers over the years. I was the only one who said, and I said it cautiously, I said, I think things will be better, because I can't imagine that they would get any worse. And of course they got worse. We saw a reality winner be handed a 5.25 year sentence for releasing something that shouldn't have been classified in the first place. And then we saw an FBI agent, Terry Albury, get 4 years in a federal prison, not in a camp, but in an actual prison, for sending a document to The Intercept that showed that there was systemic racism in the FBI. Why is that classified in the first place? So things are actually getting worse for national security whistleblowers under Donald Trump.
Right. And just in the linguistic play, you know, I overheard someone I can't attribute, but I liked it. It resonated. They said, we're not the resistance. You know, Trump is the resistance. We are the swooshing through it. And I like that. I like that reversal, because resistance is a losing, and then we go, whoosh, the deconditioning. So there's, you know, and then also, you know, you were mentioned the other night, I went to the Committee for the Republic's, you know, honoring of Cy Hirsch, and I think they'd awarded you something important some years back, you know, and it's a quirky gathering, right? And Cy Hirsch, you know, Bruce Fein did not show up, who was going to do a constitutional law thing, and so Cy Hirsch was just sort of scattershot and ricocheting around, going, oh, you know, and my lie, I was bamboozled then, it wasn't really Lieutenant Calley, but enough about that, you know, just, but he did say a couple of things. I mean, and it was like, no, come back here. But he said, you know, there are people in every agency, there's corruption, of course, but who have taken their oath seriously. So there is integrity in all of these, you know, complex realms, of which you're a really good guy, somewhere in all of the agencies. And then he also said, you know, look at all these people running. I don't know. Eric Holder, for goodness sake, is thinking of running. That's crazy. You know, but he said to out and about, because it is crazy. But he did say, you know, out and about, you know, there's a huge popular support for Trump. And he said any Democratic candidate who runs primarily against Trump will lose. And it's like, ooh, a little cold frisson and thing. But, you know, but yeah. So what is your take on that?
Well, first of all, I'm a big, big fan of Cy Hirsch's. I'm a member of a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and we gave him our Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence a couple of years ago in October of 2017. I guess it was a year and a half ago. And then last night he was given an award called the Defender of Liberty Award from a group called the Committee for the Republic. It's a libertarian group, mostly Republican, I suppose, but there are a lot of us progressives there too. And I've always considered
Were you there?
I was there.
Oh, I was there. Okay, I didn't see you. Yeah,
we should have. I was standing in the back by the bar. We should have connected.
We should. Well, next time around. Yeah,
that's right. But Cy Hirsch, you know, Cy Hirsch is exactly the person that should be emulated in this country. Every journalism student should want to be like Cy Hirsch. And you notice in the stories that he told, He protected all of his sources. He told some stories that I had never heard. David Petraeus, for example, that David Petraeus was keeping an uncleared laptop in his desk at the CIA, and he was not taking it home in the evening, and he was not taking it on foreign trips with him. And finally, a security officer, when Petraeus was out of the office, opened the computer to see what the heck was on it. And because it was not an agency computer, he could do that. And Cy said that he's not going to go into details about what was on the computer, but suffice it to say that what was on the computer could have sent David Petraeus to prison for most of the rest of his life. And he was never charged.
So we're thinking child porn?
That was the first thing that came to my mind.
I think everybody in the audience. Yeah.
It's more common than a lot of people realize, I think. But yeah,
right.
I mean, I was frightened by that.
Well,
who knows?
Yeah, I mean,
and then the other thing is, when the fix is in, if you're a friend of the president, or if you have four shiny stars on your shoulder, you can do essentially anything you want, and you're not going to have to pay any price for it. You know, besides what Cy mentioned the other night, David Petraeus, and beside what he pled guilty to, a misdemeanor charge of giving his girlfriend classified information, he was not charged for revealing the identities of 10 covert CIA operatives. Now, that's a violation times 10 of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. That's what I was in prison for. And he could have gone to prison for 100 years for outing the names of these covert operatives, but he was never charged. And they call that prosecutorial discretion. And it's because he was a friend of the president's.
Well, which president?
Obama.
Oh, really? Huh. So, yeah,
he was
so
golden boy.
Oh, okay. Right. So there's all that because I'm glad you were there because Cy Hirsch and you're more familiar with his cadence, right? And Bruce Fine didn't show up, so he was going all over. But I'm glad you caught that because it was like, yeah. And the sound system wasn't that great, so us in the front were like,
no,
what,
terrible.
David? I'm sorry. Say what?
The sound system was terrible in that room.
It was terrible. Well, you know, and it is a quirky thing. I do go to the Committee for the Republic. I'm a little bit of their mascot. I've gone to CPAC with them, right? It's not exactly a libertarian group. It's hard to know. There are Tea Party there people who are, you know, sort of, you know, you can talk to everybody. There's conservatives that are appalled and frightened about the state of democracy. There's interesting conversations to be had across borders. I ran into my favorite conservative, I forget the last name, and I go back to his our initial conversation in which I was introduced at a Committee for the Republic, and somebody said, that's the most conservative person in the room at this party, go talk to him. And we hit it off, and he said, what do you know about Edmund Burke? And I said, well, really not much. And he said, well, this conversation about small government, big government's irrelevant. What Edmund Burke said is, the more we cultivate, you know, deep citizen qualities, the fewer outer rules we need. And I said, well, this is a great conversation, across borders.
Yes,
this
it is,
you know. It is. And, you know, I said, this is metaphysics, this is Taoism. And he goes, I love Taoism, and I haven't been able to talk about Taoism with any of my conservative friends. Here, let's go have a drink. But it is a good conversation, you know, and for yourself to go, you know, what are the qualities of citizenship? And I do love, you know, your Carl Jung Merlin self, you know, because you did go to the underworld. And as we've talked, as we spoke in the previous two times where you've been marvelous guest, and you loved Mission Impossible. Dun, 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 dun. And you entered. I'm sorry, say what?
You remember that?
Oh, sure, of course. No. You're one of my most playful, you know, guests, even though we want to lighten you up because you carry so much. We go, But so you enter, you know, the undercover realm. You then discover, you know, horrific things after a while. You then go to prison for 2 years and you emerge, right? And this is, and you're still in this process of emerging and reinventing yourself, right?
Yeah, true.
Yeah. And but this is a powerful mythic journey, and I think, you know, many of the most trustworthy people are people, you know, and many of the positive men, you know, they go to the underworld, they do some sketchy things, they, you know, whatever, and then they return, you know, and it's one of the oldest themes. 231 BC in China are the oldest detective novels, and it says the purpose of the magistrate is to dive into the underworld to restore human affairs to be in accord with, you know, harmony, the mandate of heaven and earth. And they say in the underworld it's good to have a buddy with whom to smart talk, you know, and to have dark humor, which you have, right?
I think I do.
Well, let me finish this sentence and toss it back to you. But and they say in the underworld, your greatest protection is authenticity, because bad people will come up and want to harm you. But if you're real, if you're aspiring to be real, as we all, may it be so, then here's what will happen. Bad people will come up and go, I was going to rob you and kill you, but I sense that you're real. So I want to be on your team, but I have underworld skills you will need. This is all the way back from 231 BC in China, but I find it so pertinent right now. And for your whistleblower self and the community, you know, of, you know, Tom Drake and Bill Binney and all those people that, you know, maybe went to underworld, maybe did some sketchy things, you know, but then come back. So, you know, and you wrote about this too in your book, you know, but what do you think, what are the underworld skills we need, and how do we extend an invitation to more whistleblowers? You know, come, we need your underworld skills, come join the authentic team.
Well, the world has changed, and it's all about IT and computers and hacking now. There was a terrific article today in an obscure paper that one of my veteran intelligence professionals colleagues sent around, and it was about a woman who spent 10 years at NSA and then decided to go into the private sector to make some money. She went to a company that got a contract with the United Arab Emirates, the government of the UAE, spying on, intercepting the telephone calls of Emirati dissidents and human rights activists and labor leaders and people like that. And she was perfectly fine doing that. That's what she was doing at NSA. And then they asked her to start listening to the phone calls of Americans who were in the UAE. And that's where she drew the line. And she said, certainly the technology is there. And certainly there are other Americans who gladly intercept the conversations of Americans and report back to a foreign government. But she said, in her mind, that's what made her one of the bad guys. And that was a line she was unwilling to cross.
Right. But she has underworld skills that we will need, right? I mean, we want the hacking,
you know,
team.
My second book was called Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. And what I did is I took 20 sort of underworld life lessons that the CIA taught me, and I show how I use those life lessons to survive and thrive in prison and remain safe and at the top of the social heap. And some of them I put in as a joke, like admit nothing, deny everything, make counter accusations. But there were others that were very serious, make somebody else do your dirty work, or always be aware of your surroundings, you know, things like that. There are skills that we all have that we may not even realize we have, or skills that we can be taught easily that keep us ahead.
Well, but
and
let's,
you know,
look,
that,
not, well, wait a minute, but not so fast. Make somebody else do your dirty work, meaning like what?
Okay, I'll give you an example from the book. There was a serial killer in our prison. He was doing 40 years. He killed a dozen prostitutes in the 1970s, and he had been a long-distance truck driver. We called him Truck, and he was very violent. He would just meet people for no reason at all at the drop of a hat. For whatever reason, this guy constantly sought my approval. I have no idea why. I tried hard to avoid him because he was so violent and so deadly. But every once in a while, he'd say, hey, I saved you a seat in the TV room, or hey, there's a new
radio station that plays classic rock. So I didn't want him to, you know, flip out like the crazy person that he was, and I would just say thank you, appreciate you thinking of me, etc. Well, there was another guy in there who we called the Cat in the Hat, because he had this grotesquely elongated head, and he actually looked like the Cat in the Hat. Well, he was in on a murder for hire charge. He hired someone to kill his business partner, and when they got caught, he ratted the hitman out. Well, he wanted to live in my cell, and I had a rule in my cell: no rats and no pedophiles. So I said, listen, you're not going to live in my cell. I said, I don't like your crime. I think it's a cowardly crime, and it's even more cowardly because you ratted the guy out. So you're not living in my cell. Well, he had it out for me because I wouldn't allow him in. One day, I got a call to go to the lieutenant's office. They called on the loudspeaker, Kiriakou to the lieutenant's office. Now, the reason I was called down was because I had an interview request from CNN, and they wanted to know if I wanted to accept the interview request. But usually when somebody's called to the lieutenant's office, it's either to be taken to solitary confinement because you've done something, or because you're a rat and they're calling you down to ask you a question. They want you to rat somebody out. Well, I was no rat. So I went down and I signed the approval for CNN, and I went back up to the TV room and I sat down, and Truck was sitting next to me. Well, Cat in the Hat was standing about 3 feet away, and for whatever reason, he just didn't see. He didn't notice that I was sitting right there, 3 feet away from him. And he said to a prisoner who was standing next to him, did you hear they called Kiriakou to the lieutenant's office? That guy's a rat. And Truck said to me, did you hear that guy? He just called you a rat. And I said to Truck, and this is where that rule comes in, make others do your dirty work. I said to Truck, 2 hours ago, I heard him call you a pedophile.
Woohoo!
And without missing a beat, Truck got up and beat him into a bloody pulp. He was unconscious. They called, they put the red light on and the siren, and everybody has to go back to their cells. And what they ended up doing is they took both of them to solitary confinement. Truck was given an assault charge, and they added 3 years to his sentence. And Cat in the Hat spent 6 weeks in solitary and then came out. Well, people had told him in the meantime what had happened, that I had done this, which I was happy to tell him to his face that I had done it. And he came up to me very humbly with his head down, and he said that he was sorry for calling me a rat and that he'll never do it again. And I said very softly, if I ever hear my name cross your lips again, you're dead. And we left it at that. I never had to raise my hand. I never had to lift a finger. I let Truck do my dirty work. And that's an important rule when you're in prison.
Right. Whoa. Yes. No. And we're in this realm that is part of your beat of high levels of ambiguity and survival. It was not quite you being the bodhisattva. It was you being the survivor. And we go, whew. But what was the second? Okay, make somebody else do your dirty work. Okay. All right. Well, what was the second thing? Again, the lessons from being a spy.
It was. Admit nothing, deny everything, make counter-accusations.
Yes.
That was a good one. You know, at the CIA store, at the employee store, we actually had coffee mugs with that printed on them and T-shirts that had that printed on them. It was a joke at the CIA, but I actually used it to my benefit in prison. Once I got called down to the lieutenant's office because there had been a fight in the housing unit, and I just happened to be standing there when the fight broke out, and somebody, some rat, told the lieutenant, oh, you should ask Kiriakou. He was standing right there when the fight broke out. So I was called down to the lieutenant's office, and I remembered my rule: admit nothing, deny everything, make counter-accusations. So the lieutenant said, why don't you tell me about this fight in the housing unit? And I said, there was a fight in the housing unit? I didn't know anything about it. And he said, come on, I know that you were standing right there. And I said, oh, yeah? I think maybe you were fighting in the housing unit. How do you like that? Maybe you should be reporting on yourself. Maybe you're the one that started the fight. Well, he was so frustrated by my nonsensical accusations that he told me just get out of here. And that's exactly what I wanted him to tell me. So I didn't have to rat on anybody. I didn't report on anybody. And I didn't tell him anything that he could use. Finally, as I was walking out, I said, what, you want me to do your job for you now, too? They knew better than to ask me.
Right. Well, we're going to take a very, very short break for a moment and come back and then liberate your considerable skills, you know, going, well, that is hardcore and that's what you got to do in that circumstance, perhaps. But we go onward because we want to put the confirmation of William Barr in Yemen and Venezuela and Brazil and La Lomita and the butterflies on the table. But we'll be right back after this very short Taj Mahal break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, our fellow dragon guest on Valentine's Day. tough words, that's really okay. We're going to chew these up here. We're welcoming the return of John Kiriakou. You can go to his website, johnkiriakou.com, or follow him on Twitter at John Kiriakou. Well, yeah, whew. All right, it's not exactly how we want to be, but we understand that.
No,
and now that you've come back, you know, the power of language and all. But that's how the Trumps, that's how the Bannons play, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. The stakes are very high. Whether it's politics or it's life in prison, yes, the stakes are very high.
Right. No. Actually, what you said, the hardcore nature of it makes me feel like a kind of delicate New Age wimp going, oh no, that's but all right, back we are into the gritty.
Let me add something to that. While you're saying that you don't want to be like a delicate New Age wimp, at the same time, I'm using these rules and I'm thinking, God, I don't want to be a sociopath. You know?
Yeah.
You
have to take
on the persona of a sociopath in order to manipulate people like that. And it's not a nice thing.
Well, that's the thing. It's like I've met a number of people, the likes of yourself and whistleblowers, and then people who had really, really difficult lives. You know, their mother was married to a con. They went into foster care. Mm-hmm. They became cage fighters, mm-hmm. you know. And they would say, and I did terrible things to survive. And now I teach yoga and sell real estate and try and help troubled youth. You know, anyway. So, I like the whole into the thing and to know that, you know, and remember in mythology, you know, the greatest saint, you know, in all of Tibetan Buddhism, was a murderer and a highwayman, right? So I'm really interested, and I want to toss to you about this quality of redemption, and then I just have always felt also that you also have, you know, how I filled the time while we were trying to reach you, was also, you know, the language craft and the journeying back, you know, having survived with those skills that you now get to kind of edit and tell us about and that's how rough the people in office, you know, the Bannons and all do play, but now we're back to the realm of, you know, liberating and bardic. Because you do have great language skill. Yes you do.
I do. I'm fortunate. I speak both Greek and Arabic, and I mean even in English. I'm an accomplished writer, thank goodness. The CIA taught me very well it's writing style, and I've written three books, one of which won two literary prizes, and I'm working on my fourth right now.
Right, and then there's also the movie that was nominated for an Emmy in 2016 that I have somewhere.
Right, here. We were nominated for an Emmy, Silenced.
Yes, right, here it is. How one film gave voice to three whistleblowers the U.S. government tried to silence, and can people find that?
Yeah, until recently it was on Netflix and Amazon. It's still on in the iTunes store, and it's called Silenced, past tense.
Right. The treatment afforded whistleblowers who don't have the right connections.
Yes.
Right. And as you know, and a person never feels as alone as when the weight of the entire U.S. government is coming down on your head, when espionage acts, charges are being filed against you, despite the fact that you haven't committed espionage, and when your personal, financial, and social life are ruined, said you. We go.
Yeah, I was just going to say. I think I said that.
I think you did. Yeah, that's right. It was at the end going, oh, you did say that. And then you said, and it was through the documentation that you realized you weren't alone, right? So to answer kind of the first question of what the Chinese detective novel said, you didn't really have a trustworthy, equal, you know, observational buddy in prison that you could have dark humor with. It was really just you.
I was very, very fortunate in that, and this is going to sound crazy, but you have to sort of analyze it in the context of being in prison. I was adopted by the Italians, and I use air quotes around the word Italians. These were Italians named Gambino and Bonanno and Lucchese, and they really did adopt me. And in part, it was because I hated the FBI as much as they did. But in part, it was because my arrival in this prison was foretold in the New York Times about 4 days after, or 4 days before I got there, rather. And so one of these Italians, who became my closest friend in prison, took it upon himself to go to all of the other Italians and explain to them the difference between an FBI agent and a CIA officer. An FBI agent is a cop and a rat, and a CIA officer fights overseas to keep the country safe. And so as soon as I got there, I was welcomed with open arms. I went to every Italian dinner, every Italian party. We exercised in the yard together. And I'll tell you the truth, everybody's out of prison now, and we had a reunion in Atlantic City 3 weeks ago. So they made my life very, very easy in prison.
Right. Well, yes, so you have great social skills, and you are a charismatic Leo, and a dragon. We're both dragons with the moon in Virgo, but also here's where I want to kind of, you know, encourage this part of you, which is you are a charismatic dragon, and I love the etymology because you're a word crafter as well, and so charismatic comes from charis, from which we get charitable and Eucharist and Cordelia, dedicated heart in Shakespeare. So true charisma is a charitable heart. Heart, which I gather did not have much room in prison, fair enough, but might your charitable heart be blooming now? Just say yes.
Sure it is. But you know what? It did in prison, too. And I didn't even realize it as it was happening. When I was first processed into the prison, in the 40 minutes that it took to process me in, the cop only said one thing to me. He said, "If someone enters your cell uninvited, that's an act of aggression." And I thought, great, I've been here 40 minutes and I'm going to get my butt kicked. So I was there my first day. I had been in prison by then about 2 hours. And sure enough, two Aryans walked into my cell, just walked right in. One had a swastika that took up the entire front half of his neck. And so I jumped out of my chair and I put my fists up and I said, "What do you want?" And the one with the swastika said, "Are you the new guy?" And I said, "Yeah, so?" He said, "Are you a fag?" And I said, "No." "Are you a rat?" I said, "No, I'm not a rat." "Are you a chomo?" I said, "I don't know what that word means." And he said, "Chomo, child molester." I said, "No, I'm not a child molester." And he said, "Okay, you can sit with the Aryans in the cafeteria." And I thought, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm with the Aryans now.
Not yet.
I hadn't yet met the Italians in those first few hours. So then a few days later, two African-American prisoners walked right into my cell again. One was holding a newspaper, and again I jumped up and I put my fists up. It turned out that they were with the Nation of Islam, which is not a religion in prison. It's a gang. And I was frightened, to tell you the truth. I've never had any engagement with the Nation of Islam. And the guy gingerly handed me this newspaper, which happened to be the Nation of Islam newspaper. And he asked if I was the CIA officer. I said I was. And he said that Reverend Farrakhan had said that I was a hero of the Muslim people for my position on human rights, and that I wasn't going to have any problems with them. So that helped
a lot. Then one of the Italians asked me why, his words, why do you sit with those Nazi retards in the cafeteria? I said, I don't know. My first day, they asked me to sit with them. He said, from today, you sit with the Italians. And so I had the Italians. And then finally, one of my cellmates was a Mexican, he was with a Mexican drug cartel. And he asked me if I was educated. I said that I was. And he asked if I would write his appeal. And I said, well, I'm not an attorney. And he said, but you're smart, right? And I said, I guess so. I mean, I'm not smart enough to have stayed out of prison, but I guess I'm smart enough. And so I wrote his appeal for him. Now, the guy didn't have any chance of winning this appeal, but I wrote it. And he asked me what he owed me. And I said, oh, you don't owe me anything. I have family and friends on the outside that put money in my commissary account. I'm not going to charge you for something like this. And so he put out the word among the Mexicans that I was an honorable person. And so I never had any problem with the Mexican drug cartels either. And you know, if you only have to worry about the isolated wacko like Cat in the Hat, you're okay. You're going to be fine. And so, I found myself fine.
Well, so let's tease this out into now and again into the humming strategy of all of our, you know, gentle and ferocious dedicated listeners too. So here we are. You know, the Senate just voted to confirm William Barr, okay, as the Attorney General. Yeah. You know, and this might be where some of your prison skills come in, because we are, you know, it's thugs in suits, right? I mean, it's really,
oh yeah,
you know, it's the same kind of gang quality,
and we go. Yeah, my position is that the criminals are wearing suits and they're working at the Justice Department.
Right, and let's stay there for a moment too, because Cy Hirsch was also kind of referencing this too about, you know, Democrats and people, you know, good heavens, you're honoring John Brennan, for God's sake, and these, you know, other people, and the FBI is not necessarily your friend, you know, and so, you know, to put some discerning down on the table, you know, because I know in the previous two times you've been on this show, you know, you were saying, you know, Mueller, sketchy guy, you know, just complex, yep, things, you know, and for all of us to have maybe not a complete John Kiriakou, you know, quality, but maybe two drops just into our brew to go, you know, going, you know, because, you know, these guys play rough, right, in suits, and we're all kind of in. We're all in that realm. So how would you guide us with discernment to and yet nonetheless, you know, the skill there is like you are very specifically going, I'll relate to this part of this person, but not that part.
Yes.
And over here.
You're exactly.
And
right.
And so Mueller and Cullen and, I mean, everybody, I mean, they whatever, but they do have a role to play that might be good. Yes. I just want to toss complexity back to you.
Sure. You know, I'm really reticent to make blanket statements about any person or any issue, because people and issues are very complicated. John Brennan is certainly no friend of mine. It was John Brennan who initiated the case against me. And John and I go back together to, you know, January of 1990. I've known John for almost 30 years. I don't respect him. I've never respected him. I think that intellectually he was in way over his head as CIA director. And I think he made a lot of decisions that were just morally and ethically wrong, and certainly legally wrong. With that said, I don't doubt the man's patriotism. I don't doubt the man's commitment to counterterrorism. I think that he's increasingly political. In my view, that's wrong. But I can see why he's doing it. I certainly wouldn't criticize him for that. So yeah, I mean, I think that government is better off without John Brennan in it.
But yeah.
I wouldn't begrudge the guy his career. And the same
right.
thing
well,
with Robert Mueller. You know, Mueller made a name for himself as FBI director, especially in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and somehow he has developed this reputation as being Mr. Clean. He's not Mr. Clean. He's never been Mr. Clean. You know, we should go back and look at his tenure as FBI director and look at the innocent people that he targeted. and went after. The racial profiling and the ethnic profiling and rounding up Muslims in the days and weeks and months after 9/11. Robert Mueller did a lot of things that were just wrong. They were un-American, in my view. But now all of a sudden, because so many people hate Donald Trump, Mueller is seen as this, you know, knight on a white horse. And he's not. He's a part of the problem, not a part of the solution. There was an important a piece that came out today on CBS, and it was an advanced clip of an interview that's going to be broadcast on Sunday on 60 Minutes. It's an interview with the former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. And McCabe says that in 2017, January of 2017, when Trump fired Jim Comey, FBI leaders, right, leaders decided to try to recruit a cabinet secretary to push Trump out of the presidency using the 25th Amendment, and that Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, agreed to wear a wire anytime he had a conversation with the president in order to try to trap him into saying something that sounded crazy so they could depose him. Well, that's a coup. That's not what our government and our country is all about.
Well,
that's
why. Well, that's why we want to put these things on the table for our discerning, because there are many people
indeed.
Who go, you know, or yes, or
because we are to depose the president, and it's called an election,
right?
Plain and simple,
right? Yeah. Well, so you don't think the president has committed impeachable offenses with emoluments and, you know, graft and whatnot, or the Russian and because while I was filling time.
Sure.
Right, because while I was dancing and
But then if he has, you turn the evidence over to the House of Representatives, he would be impeached there, and then he would go on trial in the Senate. That's what the Constitution calls for. You don't clandestinely and surreptitiously recruit a member of the cabinet and then have your deputy attorney general wearing a wire to try to entrap the guy. Do it above board.
You are a man of many strategies and many moods, right? So there's your navigational standards, which is you know, follow the procedure,
exactly.
You know, and
well, I mean, there's a reason why we have a constitution. I mean, the Constitution clearly lays this out. The 25th Amendment was written relatively recently to deal with an incapacitated president. A president who, for example, might be suffering from dementia, or a president who has a stroke. Not a president who just you don't like and who appears wacky and tweets crazy things. That's not why it was written.
All right, that's right. Okay, but we have precious moments left to address many things. But that's why. And that's when I was referring to your Carl Jung Merlin self, and why not, you know, what, you know, in the spirit of, you know, our ally, Edward Snowden, you know, what would you most like to be revealed, you know, for the sake of democracy, revealed and rendered harmless, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, Glenn Greenwald and The Intercept doing great work on many things, but it's a huge, you know, festival of complex narratives that we want to kind of honor and discern. And so Glenn Greenwald's like, you know, the Russian investigation is a huge distraction, and other people are like, partly true, partly not, you know, all still important, but it's not the only news going on. But what is your take there? Are we being bamboozled and distracted by the investigation, or it's got its place?
No, I think we're being distracted by the investigation. You know, so many accusations have been made of Russian intervention in our election, that the Russians hacked the election, the Russians stole the election, the Russians hated Hillary Clinton so much that they gave the election to Donald Trump. And there's never been any evidence that's been produced to indicate that that was the case. There have been individual Russians who have been charged with hacking or illegally buying $50,000 worth of Facebook ads or whatever nonsensical thing they've been charged with. But there's been no evidence that Donald Trump was an agent of the Russian government, or whether knowingly or not. So I think that's
right. Let's put that to one side on our work table for a moment, because what did make sense, and this is where Glenn, I think it was Glenn Greenwald, was also saying, but at the same time, where he's gotten impatient with Rachel Maddow, you know, is like, you know, to concentrate on that, but it's like, well, wait a minute, what are we doing in Venezuela? That was an election.
Yes.
You know,
the huge discrepancy,
yes. And I want to toss that back to you again. You know, we don't have time right now. Yemen, Venezuela, Brazil, the butterflies, La Alameda, the wildlife sanctuary on the border. Okay, we'll get to those things in the fullness of time.
Important issues.
Really?
Yeah, and I'll do it very quickly. I think that is a very, very important issue. You know, there are only three legal ways to intervene in a foreign country. One is if you are invited in by the country. One is if that country has attacked you militarily. And the last is if you have the permission of the United Nations Security Council. And we don't have any of those things in Venezuela. And so it is illegal. It is a violation of international law for us to intervene in Venezuela. They have a democratically elected president. We may not like him. We may not like his politics. We may not like the way he manages his economy. But it's none of our business. And so when we send shipments of weapons, for example, or we pick an utterly unknown 35-year-old nobody and declare that he is the new president of this country, this is a guy that literally not one single Venezuelan has ever voted for. That's anti-democratic. That is illegal. It's against the United Nations charter, and it's just simply a violation of the law. Go ahead.
Right. No, and then here we are in our waning time. We'll have to do more of this. Okay, and then Elliot Abrams also is like, conniption fits. You know, again, the horrific cartoon. People were like, shouldn't he be in a witness relocation? No, shouldn't he be just far, far away in exile? But yes, there's that. All right, so we're spiraling out. A Valentine to the world, John Kiriakou. Again, you know, what would you, in your Merlin mode, you know, what would you like to be revealed? You know, that what you just said, you know, to be available to everybody, going sane, reverent, common sense, and rendered harmless.
Every American has the right to know what its country is doing in its name. And that means not just overseas, but here domestically as well. If it hadn't been for Ed Snowden, we would have no idea that NSA was spying on us. I think we have a right to know exactly what it is that NSA is doing and has done to American citizens. And I'd like to know what the CIA is doing. Is there still a torture program? We have a right to know. The American people own that information. And it is illegal to classify a crime. So if torture is a crime, which we all know that it is, to classify that program would be illegal in and of itself. We have a right to know.
Right. All right. By the power of your Merlin self, and we'll come back to the power of language and symbols and your inner Carl Jung at another time. always a pleasure, John Kiriakou. You can find his website, johnkiriakou.com, or follow him on Twitter at johnkiriakou. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at standupcoyote and coyotenetworknews.com. Thanks always to Kirsten Thomas as great board op. And yes, many, many more things. And we will have you back to talk about Brazil and also just your powerful mojo to protect the La Alameda Chapel and the butterflies and the wildlife sanctuary on the border.
From here to God's ears.
May butterflies and the best part of humans in La Alameda Chapel, you know, prevail against all odds, against this tyranny. Thank you, John Kiriakou, and may we continue to cahoot in some form. All right, woof.
Thank you.
Thank you.